Dan, what's going on?
Pat, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. How you doing?
You know, it's Saturday night, and the only thing I can think about doing is a podcast.
Yeah.
I think that's where I am in life. How are the goats?
You know, having goats, baby goats especially, is way better than I could have ever expected. I'm pretty convinced that part of any new stimulus package that Congress puts together should include two baby goats shipped to every family in the United States.
I think that makes sense. Yeah. Two goats and like an acre of land or something like that.
Yeah.
Are we still doing that?
40 acres and a mule was the promise.
40 acres. Yeah. 40 acres. Well, we don't. No one has 40 acres anymore, Pat. Come on.
There still is that much land.
I mean, Clive Bundy does, but.
Yeah, Clive Bundy does not have that land. He's grazing his cattle on.
Go ahead and try to take it from him, Pat. Let me know how that
works. Okay. Welcome back, everyone, to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
That's right. So what are we getting fired up about today, Pat?
Cancel the rent.
Yeah, cancel the damn rent. That's right. So after four stimulus bills and several trillion dollars, it seems to me that aside from checks, which are, getting out to people, and a more robust unemployment insurance, it seems like individual Americans are not seeing the relief that they need, particularly low-income folks and those, or even middle-income folks who are in the renting class, whereas many of us who may have a mortgage, there seems to be plans in place to provide some relief.
Right, exactly.
And you're going to be sharing in just a minute some information about a nonprofit that's supporting the work of fair housing in Massachusetts.
Yeah, Urban Edge, the OGs of housing.
Is that their tagline?
No, but that's how a friend described it, and I think that's a good way of describing it. You know, they feel that housing is where the war is won and lost, and where the movement should be focused, because so many issues are around, like, where we locate people and how people can afford where they live.
Right. Well, sounds good. We'll be right back.
Stick around.
This week's episode is brought to you by Urban Edge. Urban Edge is dedicated to strengthening communities and families. Together, they build affordable housing and vibrant, prosperous neighborhoods. So Urban Edge is a national leader in the community development field. They're known for innovation, excellence in their field. The heart of Urban Edge is in Eggleston and Jackson Square. It's a vibrant, inclusive, and culturally economic diverse area of Boston. Urban Edge works with others across the city of Boston to promote high quality, sustainable, and affordable communities. Now, what they do is they help clients to find housing, find programs that will help them either get job training. They train people in how to become a first-time home buyer, how to take advantage of all programs that are available to first-time home buyers. They actually build sustainable and affordable housing themselves, and they organize movements like the Lift Me Up movement and other movements as well. There are a number of ways that you can get involved. You can volunteer by going to urbanedge.org and filling out a questionnaire to learn how you could best be useful to their organization. And you can also donate. So they've got tax write-offs available to those who can make more substantial donations. But any amount that you give can be very helpful to this organization. So go to urbanedge.org. That's urbanedge.org. You'll see a donate tab up at the top of the page, but they've got a pretty comprehensive website that explains what they do, how they do it, how they've been making a difference in communities for years, and how they have basically a multi-pronged approach to fighting homelessness, but also to building communities and making those communities strong, vibrant, and sustainable.
So, Pat, it's cool to hear about Urban Edge. That's not an organization that I'm familiar with, but I know that you have some history in the housing advocacy arena. You want to share a little bit about that?
Sure. So, when I came back from Vermont, where I went to college, I became a housing advocate. So, I worked for an organization similar to Urban Edge that operates in South Middlesex. So like Framingham and that general area, I worked basically with families that were housing insecure. So some of those families could actually be homeless and living in shelter, some of those families were about to lose their apartments. Some of those families were facing some real trouble because they hadn't paid their utilities for a long time.
Right.
And I think there's a myth that homeless individuals and homeless families are unemployed, and that was really
or not looking for work,
right? And that was really not the case too often. They were working more than one job and couldn't get full time status, and just were making minimum wage or just above that,
right?
And so that's part of the challenge of like, I'm going to put you in a shelter for now until we can find you more stable housing. Are you going to be able to get to your place of employment from this shelter? You know, so that was definitely an eye opener for me, especially in South Middlesex, where you don't always think of poverty and homelessness the way that you kind of see it more out in the open in a city like Boston. Or New York City, or you know, especially like LA.
Well, it's because it's not as dense, like the shelters or the temporary housing might be tucked into a neighborhood, as opposed to being like a quote unquote project or something that's more readily visible and much bigger.
Right. So I was assigned to a shelter that was actually the first of its kind in Massachusetts. It was a single male head of household shelter. So it was men who had custody of their kids and were homeless. And it was put right into a neighborhood in North Framingham. The neighbors were not happy about it at first. And we went ahead and did it. And it actually ended up being a pretty positive thing in the neighborhood. I think the people in that shelter really took it upon themselves to treat neighbors well and to build a positive reputation for the shelter.
That's great.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, it is personal for me. I've seen it, and I've seen the challenges that organizations like Urban Edge face as they try to combat this issue.
Awesome.
So I know that you're really into this cancel the rent movement, and you know I think that there's been some really good work done in organizing from the grassroots level. How does this strike you? Cancel the rent?
Well, I first heard about this. I saw on the news, I think it was April 1st, the first sort of full month of COVID and social distancing in Los Angeles. There was a lot of protests, and they weren't about people needing to get their hair cut, but that is you know, something that somebody could decide to protest, and these folks were essentially saying like, hey, you know, this is my biggest expense every month and I'm not able to pay it and I'm looking for relief. And thus far, I mean, there has been an appropriation in one of the CARES acts that did give money to the housing and urban development, but that doesn't, it's certainly not big enough. And I think the crisis is that for 47% of renters in America, their housing cost is more than 30% of their income. And so their cost burden, right? They cannot, even if they get a little extra help, they're still weighed down by that major bill. And 25% of people who rent are what's considered severely cost burden, meaning that they pay half or more than half of their income in housing.
Yeah. So when I was working in housing advocacy, one thing we looked for to make sure that housing would be sustainable for our clients was that they would end up paying between 15 and 20% and no more than that of their take home pay towards their housing costs.
Right. Well, you do need some sort of a limit because, you know, I was reading somewhere that, you know, most people got $1,200 per adult and $500 a kid from the first stimulus bill. And for many, like the average renter in many urban markets is paying between $1,500 and $2,000 a month for rent. So you're, you know, even if you use your entire stimulus, you still wouldn't cover 1 month's rent.
Right. Right.
And so the reason I see this being a problem is, yes, we're in a pandemic right now, right? But let's say we come out of this, let's say a year from now, and the economy's recovering, right? People who are struggling are still going to be struggling. They're probably going to be struggling more. And I really see a connection back to the financial crisis of 2009, which, as you'll recall, was fundamentally a housing crisis, right? There was subprime mortgages, which means people who were not really qualified to take on this debt, they were given the loans with very few provisions or without too many qualifiers, right? They were just kind of given the money, and hundreds of thousands of people defaulted. And not everyone knows this, but these many of these loans were backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, right? So they were federally backed mortgages.
Yeah.
And so now the federal government is sitting on, you know, many billions of dollars in bad debt. And so they sold it off at a 30 to 50% discount. And so what, these houses didn't go away, right? They didn't bulldoze them to the ground. What do you think that these, what do you think these houses are now? There, many are rentals, right?
Right.
And so I don't think it's at all ironic that two of the biggest slumlords in the United States are Steve Mnuchin and Jared Kushner.
Right. Right.
Steve Mnuchin made millions in Southern California. He's known as the foreclosure king of Southern California.
Yeah.
If you Google that, right? And Jared Kushner in Baltimore, of all places, which is strange to me because he's like a rich kid from New Jersey, and he's chosen Baltimore, I think, very strategically. Not, it was not a random choice, but because there are such a dense population of people who need rental assistance.
Yeah.
And he's milking it, right, for all it's worth. And at the same time, these gentlemen are engaged in, supposedly, like on the surface, they are supporting the American people in recovering from this crisis, right? But at the same time, they're racking up rental payments, and I would assume very shortly beginning foreclosures on hundreds and possibly thousands of affected renters in this country, and the most vulnerable too, by the way.
Right, right.
If somebody takes on $1 million mortgage and they can't pay it, it's harder to feel sorry for that person. We're not talking about people who sort of got a bigger house than they could pay for. We're talking about people who just need a roof over their head.
Right, right. And so, you know, you also bring up the fact that Kushner picked Baltimore, and a lot of landlords do that. And the reason that landlords do that is that they know that if a tenant comes in with a voucher in hand, that government portion of their rent is going to get paid like clockwork. Mm-hmm. So they know that they're not going to run into trouble. Even if the tenant isn't paying their rent for a couple months, sometimes the tenant portion, if the tenant is really cash strapped, is very, very small portion of that rental payment. So there is a profit motive behind someone like Kushner, who sets up shop in a city like Baltimore, where he knows that there's going to be that government assisted rent payment coming in.
Right. So, but won't most landlords say, so this cancel the rent, as we'll talk about in a little bit, there's a couple of 100,000 people who've already signed on to essentially say, we're not paying our rent right now as a protest. And the landlords or some of the government leaders are going to come back and say, well, now you've made it so that the landlords can't pay their mortgage, right?
Right, right. So, you are going to have – you're going to run into trouble on the landlord end here as well. But there are kind of two ways to look at this. There are the big-time landlords like Kushner or, basically these large rental agencies that own, thousands of units or tens of thousands of units of housing. But then you have, sometimes the smaller landlords, small landlords that have maybe 10 units or even up to 50, something like that, is still going to be considered a small landlord. And they kind of depend on the rent payment in order to pay off their debt obligations. Now, under our system of capitalism here in the U.S., we basically reward people who own assets, land, houses, that type of thing, or can leverage what they have to mortgage more assets. So when a landlord depends on their tenants to pay their obligations, they're essentially using their tenants and their tenants' monthly rent payments to build their own wealth, right? So they're building equity and they're building their wealth while
right on the backs of other people,
right on the backs of their tenants. So, in true socialist ideology, you have that belief that capitalism or that business owners are stealing stealing the labor of their workers. But in this housing situation, you can look at it as these landlords are essentially stealing, not in the literal way, but they're taking those rent payments and building their own wealth through that monthly rent payment. And I fundamentally, I believe that this system isn't sustainable, and we're in a crisis. And I have seen it left and right. I've seen a lot of well-written opinion pieces saying that this is a time for us to re-examine the entire system, right? Because we're in shutdown mode. We're seeing things come crashing down, and when you have a system like this, where when those rent payments stop, the whole system starts to crumble.
That's right.
We've got a system that we need to re-examine. And so I think I'm not exactly sure how that happens, but I think that people need to stand up, and that's how we get into this idea of cancel the rent. And we strike together a movement that is basically coordinating at the grassroots level and mapping out who has signed on and pledged to.
Yeah. Tell them about the heat map.
Yeah. So if you go to westriketogether.org, it's right there on their landing page. It with a yellow dot in the cities where there are multiple people who have chosen to cancel their rent. And so it's got basically a heat map. It's not exactly a heat map, but it's got, yellow markers for people who have canceled their rent. And there are 190,288 as of Saturday night.
So it sounds like they're bringing the heat.
It sounds like people are bringing the heat. And I think there are a number of people who are joining this movement, even though they actually can pay their rent right now in solidarity with people who can't. And I think that's a risky maneuver. It's a risky maneuver, but it's a strong statement to make. And that's what happens when you have a group of workers who decide to walk off the job site because of one group among their members who are being taken advantage of. And so, I think if we can help build momentum for this movement, you'll see the ranks grow from 190,000 to something even bigger.
Can I add that these are also people refusing to pay their mortgage, but I want to name a disparity in this whole process that I think is really fucked up, because you and I are both homeowners, right? So we have mortgages, and I don't know about you, but when this first happened, you know, my wife is not working right now. We are getting an unemployment check for her, but I figured, you know, I knew there were these potential relief programs. I contacted Rocket Loans, Quicken Mortgage, which is the biggest player in the United States. And they were like, sure, you don't have to pay till July 31st. Now, granted, I will still owe the full amount at that time. But I mean, it was literally, Pat, less than 5 minutes. You know, it was done online. I didn't have to talk to anybody. And it was just like the bat of an eyelash. And it was fine. Because I exist in, as a white dude with good credit, you know, been paying my bills on time, I'm not a risk at all to them, right? But if I'm a renter, even someone who's working, even someone who's been making the payments, right? You know, I'm getting a note slid under my door saying, make sure it's your obligation to pay on time. You know, these threats and intimidation that I highly doubt are being levied on people who are up to date on their payments and they're paying a mortgage versus renting. I think we have an inherent discrimination or bias, probably a better word, bias against renters.
Absolutely.
And they're inherently more risky, even if they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though it was mortgages and the sale of mortgage debt that brought on the financial crisis, you know, so it's really interesting that preference is still given to those who have mortgages and those who, you know, have taken on actually quite a bit more debt than people who are renting.
That's right. And I would just add one more thing about that before we talk about what other countries are doing about this problem, is that since the financial crisis, so between 2011 and 2017, 4 million low-cost rentals were lost in the United States and have not been replaced. And so what that means is, you know, there might be some folks who say, well, you know, hey, if you can't afford Boston or Framingham or wherever you live, why don't you just move, right?
Right.
Well, the problem is that without rent controls or some sort of bigger policy goals in place, you're gonna run up against the same problem again and again, because what is the primary motive of a landlord, especially a hedge fund landlord? It's profit, right? And so, similar to the way that many folks look at medicine and healthcare, you know, it seems to me that housing is seen as a means of profit versus a right. Like, everyone should have a roof over their head. Everyone should have health care. But with more and more units disappearing, it's not so simple as, hey, find a cheaper option.
Right. Right. And if you look at people who are fighting homelessness, there is a model that has been actually gaining traction and they're seeing success, and it's called the housing first model. So instead of helping someone find a job or treating an underlying illness, they get them into housing right away. And they find that clears up a lot of the other issues that person has. Like, maybe that person
has a security thing.
Right. Maybe that person had some health concerns. Well, now they have a safe place to sleep every night and they're getting better sleep. And some of those health issues are getting cleared up. And so, you know, it does come down to the question of whether or not we as a country prioritize and make the statement that housing is a right, that every person in this country has the right to a safe and sustainable place to live.
I agree. So what are you hearing that other countries are doing about this?
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's a patchwork, even though the Eurozone is kind of a united block in some ways. Throughout Europe, there are different models that they're using. So Italy, for instance, has suspended mortgage payments and required those landlords who are suspending their mortgage payments to do the exact same thing for their tenants. So in other words, like, you can go ahead and not pay your mortgage for the next 6 months, but you need to make sure that you are not collecting rent from your tenants. So it's basically trickle-down socialism in housing policy from the Italian government. Spain has suspended all evictions starting in the middle of March, all the way through 6 months from that statement. And this is that sounds to me as similar to kind of the way that Marty Walsh and Charlie Baker have been kind of canceling school, right? They do it piecemeal. They'll say like, you know, we're not going to come back until this date, and then we're not going to come back until next school year. You know, I feel like that 6 month marker could potentially be moved depending on how the country recovers and how people suffering from the virus heal, all that stuff, and whether or not we come up with a vaccine for the coronavirus. They've also introduced a microloan scheme that is basically helping anyone who's suffering from financial hardships to take out just enough money to pay whatever they're facing in terms of debt obligations. And then that money is, you know, it's not being required to be paid back right away. And that period of time that the money, you know, that their payments on that loan is due is flexible according to the needs of the person who's borrowing.
You know what this is making me think of, and your comment about Charlie Baker and Marty Walsh also connected to it. It's that some of this is, yes, giving people a leg up financially and giving them some relief, but it's also about creating a sense of predictability during a very unpredictable time. So people right now don't know when they're going to go back to work or when their kids are going to be able to go back to school. Right.
Right.
And so I know for me, I could have probably paid my mortgage every month on the first. That wasn't, I'm not down to my last, you know, couple thousand dollars, but I prefer the predictability of saying, hey, until July 31st, I kind of have some wiggle room.
Right.
And I think a lot of people in the United States, because of the way that the federal government has handled this and because of how so many states are handling it differently, people don't know what to expect. So saying, hey, you know what, regardless of what happens, how bad the virus gets, how schools stay open or stay closed, you know that you won't be evicted for the next 6 months.
Right.
And that will improve mental health. I think that will improve relationships between parents and their kids.
Yeah.
There's a million reasons, and it's not just to give like this socialist handout. It's good public policy.
Well, yeah, and it decreases tension, right? So you've got protesters, and you know, we can argue that they are kind of being fomented and organized by the Door Brothers who are profiting off of their personal information. But, you know, there's some real feeling there of the lack of predictability, the fact that they don't know when they can get their next haircut, and the fact that they feel like the government is coming down on them and controlling their movement.
Right.
But yeah, I think a policy like that that made them feel like they had some breathing room, you know, would potentially ameliorate their protests.
So Pat, I'm excited to pick up on this again next week, where we're gonna talk more about the role of the frontline workers.
Yeah. Right?
Don't you have a guest lined up for us?
Yeah. So I have a friend who is in the Teamsters union. He drives a truck and works with delivery drivers. He's also kind of active in his local Teamsters union. And we're going to talk about, you know, the post office, all of the delivery workers and truck drivers who really are on the front lines and are not, they're really having to act on their own or within their union to push back against business owners and managers to make sure that they're actually getting some safety precautions in place, whether that's some cleaning solution so that they can sterilize their truck at the end of the day or halfway between the, you know, in the middle of the day. There are a number of things that they're doing, but it's starting from the bottom up. And so we're going to talk to him about what he's done to ensure that his shop is clean, but also like what this looks like for those. I think about it every time a package is delivered from Amazon to our house, or I see the postal worker arriving with our mail, like the amount of anxiety that that person is dealing with, you know, it's got to be pretty significant. And so we're going to talk to someone who can kind of paint that picture for us and let us know what he's going through on a daily basis.
I'm excited to hear that, because I think we have made the term frontline worker synonymous with healthcare workers,
yeah,
which are obviously critically important, but there's several other groups of people who are kind of they're the unseen people, right? They're like behind the scenes and making the wheels turn. And if we didn't have delivery, right, if this was 1918 and we were all stuck in our houses, we'd all be going out seeking these items, right? We wouldn't just be sitting at home social distancing.
Right. We'd be trying to make our own toilet paper at home, probably.
That's true. Maybe there's something on a goat that you could use to make toilet paper. You like goat's fur.
Listen, this goat thing is the best thing I got going in quarantine. So I don't need you connecting goats to toilet paper right now.
All right. Well, Pat, I know you have to get back to it. I have a big surprise that I'm gearing up for tomorrow morning. Not having anything to do with this episode. I can't talk about it. It's too top secret. I almost got busted earlier today by one of my kids. I was told that I cannot put it on Facebook.
Oh,
so I'm going to leave that cliffhanger.
Okay.
For our audience.
Okay.
And thanks for tuning in, people.
Yeah. Check us out next week.